Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
That, of course, is the Song Court, I believe sung by Zoe Saldana, and I think number 3 on the Andorra pop charts right now. Or is it Pandora? What is the name of the planet? I don't know. I'm already lost. Okay, today, it's the Nose, first of all, and we have kind of an unusual structure here on the Nose. We might have done this once before. Pandora is what it's called. Well, isn't that a problem? You have songs from Pandora? Do you see what the problem is there? So we have an unusual structure here today on the Nose. We may have done this once before, but what we basically have is a bullpen situation. So starting on the mound with the original segment is Bill Curry, who is, I think, probably the most... Well, if you've read his essay collection, Why Avatar is Better Than Anything Ingmar Bergman Ever Did, you know how passionate he gets about that first movie. And so he'll be there. He's going to be with us for the first segment. But my guess is at the end of the segment, we're going to have the bases loaded with Sky People. And so we've got a rangy right-hander warming up in the bullpen. Jim Chapdelaine was going to come in for the Navi and punch out the side there. Meanwhile, all the way through the show, we'll have Tanisha Dugan, associate producer at Octopus Theatricals, currently in litigation with the Wheelhouse here at this station for the Octopus logo issues, and also the mother of an 8-year-old son with whom she watched the Avatar movie. One of them ran into bedtime issues. I'll let you guess which one, or you might find out, actually. Sean Murray, stand-up comedian, writer, and the host of the Nobody Asked Sean, that's S-H-A-W-N, podcast. He will be spending Tuesday trying to outbid TMZ for the Trump mugshot. He's got deep pockets. He thinks he can get it. It's not going to be cheap, that one. We're not talking about Shia LaBeouf or something here. This is going to cost some money. All right. So in the second segment, we're going to talk about Daisy Jones and the Six. That's a multi-part Amazon Prime show about a rock group that is kind of basically Fleetwood Mac, except Ringo is their drummer. We're going to begin with Avatar, with The Way of Water, the first of 4 planned sequels to Avatar, which came out when Sean Murray was the age of Tanisha Dugan's son, I think. Something along those lines. They're just getting around to doing one sequel, but now they're like shooting a whole bunch of them. They're going to drop, let's see, Avatar 3, which is Avatar Maverick, I think, is that's coming out in 2024. And then Avatar Infinity War is coming out. That's number 4, is expected out in 2026, and then another one in 2028. So you thought there weren't going to be any sequels. Now there are going to be too many sequels. All right, so if we start with Bill Curry, that's going to take us right up to Science Friday. So I'm going to hold him in reserve and talk to the other folks first. So, Sean Murray, I know for a fact, because as usual, you wanted to get into a fight with me about this, that you are passionately in favor of Avatar movies, and maybe this one as well. We should say this one's 3 hours long, except that when you've watched it for 3 hours, you still have 12 minutes left to go. Just give people a little thumbnail, you know, how you feel about how this one worked.
Well, first, Colin, I'd like to say that The Way of Water has no beginning and no end. Our hearts beat in the womb of the world. The sea is your home before your birth and after your death, and the sea gives and the sea takes. I thought it was great.
Hey, Sean, I didn't book you just to come on here and read your tattoos out loud.
my tattoos are much longer than that. I thought it was great. You can't count out Big Jim. You know, the thing is, I wasn't even particularly fond of the first Avatar. I thought it was good. You know, everyone, the 3D, whatever. But it's also like the same criticisms that everyone had about like, hey, it's just basically Fern Gully or whatever white savior movie, Dances with Wolves, whatever, you name it. Basic plot, unobtainium, all that stuff. It sucked. All that stuff sucks. The dialogue's not great. But it works. I rewatched it this year, end of last year in preparation to watch Way of Water. I was like, this is better than I remember. And then I watched Way of Water and I'm like, this guy's the best. He's the best. Like, he's like, the water looks like water. Like, that's like, shouldn't be impressive, but it is. I don't know. It works. Like, the dialogue's not great. I'll give anybody that.
Right.
He should probably get another pass on the script, but take that out of it. I mean, he knows how to shoot action better than anybody. He's like, he cares about the technical side of it more than anybody ever has. Like, maybe other than like Kubrick. I mean, Nolan's up there as well, but like, the water looks like water. Like, and that shouldn't mean anything except for the fact that they just put out a Little Mermaid trailer from the same studio, essentially, and it looks like garbage. It doesn't look like water. So if a guy can make water look like water and it's not real water, hey, A plus.
All right, so that Tanisha can give notes on the dialogue, we're going to play a little clip here. You're going to hear these are the bad people. Edie Falco plays General Ardmore. She's trying to wrap this whole thing up so she can get home for Meadow's graduation. Phil Brown is Stringer, and Stephen Lang is Quaritch. He's the bad guy. He's the bad guy in the first movie. He's the bad guy in this movie. I guess we can sort of explain to you later how he gets to be the bad guy in this movie. But for now, Kat, let's just play A1.
Earth is dying. Our task here is to tame this frontier. Nothing less than to make Pandora the new home for humanity. But before we can do that, we need to pacify the hostiles. Sully's raids are becoming bolder and more frequent. Strikes are well planned. We've got tight coordination between his ground and air assets. His forces are hitting our outlying sites, the mines, pipelines, cutting off our supply chain.
And they hit a maglev 2 days ago.
Any intel on Sully's base of operations?
Yeah, give me the mountains. It's a cave system in the Hallelujah Mountains somewhere. But every time we send our forces up there, we take losses. Our hardware really stirs up the hornet's nest. We only get 10 minutes in enemy airspace. They are all over us. Colonel, we believe your blue team will be perceived as indigenous and will not trigger the immune response.
And how might we test that hypothesis, General?
The hard way.
Outstanding.
Okay, before Tanisha goes, I have to say that other than finding out right there that Leonard Cohen has his own mountain range, I actually stopped the thing right there and turned to my partner and said, I don't understand what's happening. And we're like, I don't know, 7 minutes in. So I had to stop and go on Wikipedia and find out what was going on. All right. So, Tanisha, you and your 8-year-old were actually sort of, you know, I don't know. You were Siskel and Ebert on this one. How did it go? And
we were movie dating. And it's funny. My partner said London would be a much better guest on this radio show than you because he did not sleep through it. He was awake through the entire movie and loved it. But before I dive into the movie, I just have to shout out one, the intro today, hilarious, fun, the perfect way to get into a Friday. The review of the water watering as the baseline for a movie being good has to be the lowest bar I have heard in a while, but shout out to the water watering. And back to the movie, Ms. Falco, a fellow Purchase Mafia member, doing the most with the least amount of words. I'm not surprised you had no idea what the plot was, because even though those sentences were quite basic, they didn't reveal much of where we were going other than to the mountaintop. And in hopes that we will be saved, I guess. I, unlike my friend Sean here, was not as ardent of a fan of this movie. And I don't quite understand why the first one needed a sequel, let alone three more. I think we know the colonizers will colonize. We know that the savages will savage. And there is always a dot, dot, dot to be left because we never know what the end is. I give this, you know, let's watch it because it's good for the kids. It is very blue. I do not recommend watching it on a small screen. I actually think this is a movie, I guess, like Top Gun, that must be seen in the theater, because I think the immersion of the film itself is far more substantial when it's surrounding you actually than your attempt to sort of look at it through a small screen.
Right. So I will quickly say, and I'm not really the person who should be trying to do this, but yes, this Sean did a smart thing rewatching the first movie, because you kind of need to remember stuff. And so what's happened this time is all the bad people from the first movie, they now can be downloaded into blue avatar figures. And just continue to be bad people. And that's the thing that's kind of being referenced in that clip. And it was the thing that I didn't quite understand. I had to look it up in Wikipedia. All right, Bill Curry. It's a big buildup, but you have the conch shell in your hand now. That's actually from a different IP. But what do you have to say to us about all this?
Well, lots of people don't like this movie. And It reminds me, you know, of our politics, you know, that we're deeply divided, and people on either side can't even imagine what the other side's thinking. And I like it for a lot of reasons. And I appreciate the technology of it. You know, Cameron, one of the reasons people don't like this movie is that Cameron himself is not likable. And I think there are other reasons. A lot of people just don't like science fiction. The dialogue is so wooden and stale so often, even though the plots really work and drive the movie, you know, like a Lamborghini, the dialogue itself, if he'd given Robert Towne a few bucks to punch it up, it would have been a much better film. Having said all that, the technology is amazing. James Cameron helped develop the Mars rover cameras. He has poured his life into creating cameras that can create effects that nobody else has ever created. You know, you go back to Lumiere. I mean, this is a major figure in the progress of the industry for that reason alone. He's also he's in love with water. You saw The Abyss. As I said to you guys beforehand, you know, he thought he could just take Avatar and add water and that would make a better movie, because he really loves water. And he went down, you know, to the 7 miles down to the bottom of the Mariana Trench. He went with Ballard and photographed the Titanic, creating the most haunting images in that movie. And so he's done things to sit. This movie is, even if you don't think it's great, you probably think it's great to look at, because it's so innovative in all that way. And he has such a good eye. I'll just wrap up. I think the other problem with the movie has had is in the message. And I look at all this, for my taste, Marvel Universe trash that has nothing to say, that is an abdication of the great, noble line of science fiction from Metropolis to The Day the Earth Stood Still, and Star Trek and Blade Runner and 2001, where people use science fiction to say something important, to help us see ourselves by thinking at first that we weren't. And now we're just inundated with science fiction that does absolutely none of that. It's just a constant festival of blood and violence. And this guy was making a statement, Cameron, about, it couldn't be any clearer, and I know it was really strong, that, you know, about oppression, about colonial exploitation, about the extraction of resources, about racism, and above all, about violence. It's hard to name another movie for me, and I've seen a bunch, that took such great care to make sure that when you left the theater, you thought violence was bad. And I just give him great credit for that. I was very moved by Avatar, a little less moved by The Way of Water, but I was so moved by Avatar for lots of those reasons.
I'm going to go really quickly here. Yeah, go ahead, Tanisha, yeah.
I think that's why I prefer the first one. And maybe there's nostalgia because, as you said, it was a long time ago and I was a different person at that point. But I think the trouble with this one is that he is talking about these important subjects, but there's no personal connection to it. And maybe the, you know, we need a different writer, right? And a different writer with a closer sense of the reality of what colonization does to a person, does to a family, might make this better, but it all just feels broad strokes. I mean, there's so many times that I kind of rolled my eyes because I knew what he was attempting to do, but felt that there was a deeper way, not to use any more water puns, but there's much more depth to be surfed in these topics he's bringing up, and he did it better the first time. And to continue to be in the conversation, you know, maybe, you know, it's a different movie, but I want to know about Jake and Thierry. I want to understand how the two of them raising biracial children in a hostile situation are able to go through what they're going through. I want to understand how the son who feels like the outcast because he's, you know, if we're thinking about it in American terms, because the melanation is a little too dark, right? There's too much of a tell of who he is, what his family story is, to allow him to slide through in a different way. And so, yes, I applaud Cameron for using sci-fi to remind us of these stories, but he needs some support to deepen the stories that he wants to tell.
You know, actually, Sean, I think you and I are probably on the same page about this vis-a-vis Mr. Curry's vile calumnies against the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But actually, the Marvel Cinematic Universe is exactly where dialogue is really, really good, actually. That's one of the things that they do well. They are kind of connected to that long string of decades of very witty action comedies where, you know, I mean, Robert Downey is the guy kind of tossing off all these little Cary Grant kind of jokes all the way through. This franchise needs Marvel Cinematic Universe writers, Sean.
It definitely needs better writers. I don't know if I would go Marvel writers, just because Marvel has also swung too far into being like everything is witty and zippy and, like, you know, it is like the world is exploding. Why is everyone making puns right now? Like what is this about? Like, you know what I mean? So it's a little bit too much, but I do agree, especially early Marvel was very good at, like, you know, kind of that dialogue was super sharp.
Sean, this movie has five writers: Cameron, Jaffa, Silver, Friedman, and Salerno, who actually handled my divorce as well. But
where's Salerno and Barnes?
Somebody's out there writing. But anyway, continue your thought.
No, I do agree that maybe it could have been deeper in the sense of, like, I was going to say the human story, but it's not. They're not humans. They're Na'vi, of course. But I also think, to Tanisha's point, she's like, this maybe not the story he's trying to tell. And that's why I was kind of saying, like, I know I said the water looks like water, and I'm kind of joking. But what I mean is that, like, there is a story he's telling beneath this. But for the most part, these movies are tech demos. The best tech demos of all time, I would say. Like, he cares as much about the water as he does about the story. And I think he really does care about, like the colonialism and all that stuff about it. But I think ultimately what he wants to do is show you that, hey, I can make water look better than water. You know what I mean? I think that's pretty cool. I connected with the story more than Tanisha, perhaps, just in the sense of, like, watching Jake attempt to be a father who's a Marine, you know, former Marine, and he's trying to remain stern and also try to be loving, and, like, the struggle of that, the failure of that, you know what I mean? The moments when he's like, he's trying to be like, so many times he's like, he's trying to go into the situation with a plan. He doesn't have a plan. He just has to be tough. You know what I mean? And that, it's not always going to work. And it pushes away his son for most of the movie. And I don't know. I connected with it more than she did, but I don't necessarily mean that's, I'm right. You know what I mean? I just feel like, there is depth there. I do think it, again, you know, it's a little basic in terms of just saying, like, hey, those guys are bad and we're good. You know what I mean? In terms of, like, delivering the message. But I think there's something there.
I just, before Bill weighs in, I do want to say, just from my own part. So I've been giving Bill a hard time for apparently 14 years about this. I was actually once interviewed online,
like,
by a blog called, there was a blog called, I mean, Women with Glasses or something. And they one time interviewed me, and all their questions had to do with glasses. And they said, what was your favorite movie moment that involved, you know, removing glasses, eyeglasses? glasses. And I said, it was probably an avatar when I knew I could take off my glasses and go out to my car. So I was dreading this. Bill called me up months ago and said, I know it's the pandemic, but we have to go see Avatar. I said, are you out of your mind? It's like, if I'm going to break, you know, quarantine, it's not going to be to see an Avatar movie. But so all of that said, I really liked it. I had a really great time. I think could probably beat Tanisha in a falling asleep watching a movie contest by, I don't know, 20, 25 minutes. I was awake. My partner was really in shock. At 192 minutes, I'm still here. I just thought it was a really ripping, great story. I'm not there for the message. James Cameron has nothing to tell me about anything, but it's just really exciting. I was just going, this is really freaking exciting. So I was sort of the gleeful moron, and I
gleeful 8-year-old.
Yes, exactly. I could have watched this with your kid. London and I probably should be hanging out more.
probably.
Yeah. I think he might be a bad influence on me, though. All right, Bill, you need to kind of wrap things up here in, you know, I don't know, 78 minutes or so.
So I love a good joke as much as the next guy, which is why I pray that one day I'll tell one. And I get that would help. And from the first frame of this movie, for either movie, you see that it needs that kind of thing. I would also point out that it's amazing in those Marvel movies. I don't know what the ratio of wisecracks to deaths is, but it's clear that the former desensitizes to the latter, and that it's all a part of, for me, a kind of cynicism. I think the degree to which we've been desensitized to violence and learned to accept it. And it goes back decades, you know, from Clint Eastwood to Charles Bronson to Vin Diesel and The Rock and whoever. Almost every movie that sells a lot of tickets in America ends up by justifying a human death. Even Kevin Costner pushes the gangster off a building at the end of The Untouchables.
Spoiler!
And ethics. And so I would just say, you know, that here is one time, I know it's didactic, but didactic didn't start out as an epithet, as an insult. You know, Bertolt Brecht is didactic. He gets up and he makes a point that our whole culture is, and especially our movie culture, is missing out on terribly, hasn't heard, can't recognize. And that is a very strong message about the nature of violence, how it's used. One of the reasons this movie is so much more popular overseas than it is in America is that the villains here are the American, really Marines, basically, and the heroes are the tree huggers, and corporate greed and colonial exploitation, and all these things are just laid out like they haven't been in any movie that comes quickly to mind for me. And so I started out liking this so much because I gave him enormous credit for what he'd done. And I just hope there's a little too much Harrison Ford, Liam Neeson, father saving his family stuff in the second one. I hope that in the third and fourth, he returns a little more strongly to those themes, because it's what makes this thing so powerful.
Well, Tanisha will like it even less if that happens. But anyway, we have to stop there. I do want to say, Vin Diesel movies, they're about family, man. Fast and Furious movies. It's all
there
about
is.
That's like family, man. Family. All right. Bill Curry, ladies and gentlemen, thanks very much for being with us. Jim Chapdelaine is warming up in the bullpen as predicted. Bases loaded with Sky People. We'll see whether Jim can get him out in the next segment.
Jim Chapdelaine from Stillwater.
Protect you from paying for my sins, and I've been walking this earth long enough that death's a gift. Been living this life.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. The FDA has recently approved Zepbound, a new medication for chronic weight management. Dr. Davita Umashankar, Hartford HealthCare's System Medical Director of Medical Weight Loss, tells us more.
Zepbound helps decrease hunger and increase satiety levels. Taking this medication for 72 weeks, people can see at the highest dosage approximately 48 pounds of weight loss. So definitely a powerful drug and another powerful tool that we have to utilize to help individuals who struggle with obesity.
For those ready to explore their medical weight loss options, Dr. Umeshankar has advice on the first, most important step.
I don't think anyone knows you better than your own primary care physician. So having that conversation whenever you feel ready is so important because these medications are quite powerful and do need to be monitored on a regular basis.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
That is the Patti Smith song that constitutes the opening credits for all episodes of Daisy Jones and the Six. It's interesting, you know, theme songs for TV shows, you hear them a lot more. You're for your eyes only, you hear that once. Anyway, joining us now, as I say, coming in from the bullpen, the rangy right-hander Jim Chapdelaine, Emmy-winning musician and a patient advocate for people with rare cancers, and a guy who's been in a lot of rock bands where everybody just slept with everybody else. Tanisha Dugan is associate professor at Octopus Theatrical. Sean Murray, stand-up comedian, writer, host of the Nobody Asked Sean podcast. So Daisy Jones and the Six, a musical drama docuseries. Kind of. I guess it is a docuseries. Tells the story of the fictional 1970s rock band Daisy Jones and the Six. You guessed. It is based on a 2019 novel by Taylor Jenkins Reid, developed for television. It is focused very much on the drama between two principals, Daisy Jones, the singer, and Billy Dunn, whose band Daisy Jones has kind of stepped into. And there is a tremendous amount of alleged chemistry between the two of them, kind of a moonlighting thing, Cybill Shepherd, Bruce Willis kind of thing happening, except way more drugs than was on Moonlighting. All right, I'll shut up. Jim Chapdelaine, since you have not spoken so far in the show today, we'd like you to go first. And also, you're the one who really knows what it's like to be in rock bands where just people are snorting cocaine off of Town and Country magazine covers. So how did you do with Daisy Jones?
Well, let me finish this line off the Town and Country magazine cover first, Carl. I think I'm actually the first person to actually play the part of Bill Curry.
Yes, you are.
I'm not sure if that's – I might be. I'm not sure. You know, my feelings about this thing are evolving because I finished it, 2 hours ago. and finishing it is a lot different than being halfway through it with this, I think, at least for me. Here's what I particularly like. Period correct gear and recording studio environment, correct guitars, correct amplifiers. I could have used the lead singer, Billy Dunn, if he had like two shirts instead of one shirt for the entire series. I figured with a budget like that, they could probably get him another shirt at some point. So, you know, it's hard to tell. Sometimes it feels like, oh, there's a really... They caught something deep here. Sometimes it feels like a cartoon. I have been in a lot of bands. I've never been in one that was that successful. I've been on buses, and mostly people want to get on the bus and sleep. They certainly had copious amounts of drugs. And Fleetwood Mac, who it's alleged that this is based on, also had access to copious amounts of drama and drugs. So maybe it's just something I haven't seen. I'm still kind of formulating if I liked it or not, as just independent of the music part. But I did do some research. I'm impressed by this. Is Elvis's granddaughter.
Yes.
I like that. And also that Sam Claflin is British, and he does a pretty good one-dimensional American.
Yeah, they're always able to do that. I do want to say that your current band, the Shinolas, does abuse like cough drops and other lozenges.
Our primary drugs of choice are Lipitor and Voltaren.
All right. So yes, they've gone from hip to hip replacement. So before we hear, Tanisha is really going to weigh in on what they wore and why, I think, in Daisy Jones and the Six. But let's hear a clip. Here's the aforementioned granddaughter of Elvis, Riley Keough, as Daisy Jones. Sam Claflin is Billy Dunn, and here they go, B1 Cat.
Can I ask you a question? What do you think the song's about?
What do I think the song is about? What do I think the song that I wrote is about? It's about starting a new life, okay. Daisy. It's about redemption.
Redemption from what?
From letting people down.
So guilt. It's about guilt.
No, it's not about guilt.
I'm sorry, I'm not trying to pry or anything. I'm just trying to, you know, get us on the same page and understand the story better so that I can help, which is, I think that's why I'm here. I'm assuming it's about you. Okay, so you let somebody down, right? And now you're saying, you know, everything's fine. Look at us now. Everything's in the past.
What's wrong with that?
I don't believe it. And it doesn't sound honest, and it sounds simple. And I don't know you very well. You don't seem simple to me.
Oh, thank you.
Also, why did you call it Honeycomb? You know that's a Ricky Nelson song, right?
If you don't like this song, why are you here?
Oh, I love the song. I love it. I think it's a beautiful song. It's just that you wrote a speech, Billy, when at the very least I think it can be a conversation.
I should say at the end of this segment, you'll hear the song that they're talking about. So, Tanisha, I promised them a fashion critique, but you don't have to do that. What do you want to say about Daisy Jones and the Six?
I mean, I'll do a little of both. One, obviously, this is far more up my alley than the Avatar, because it's
got excellent. I guess I'd say there's a little water in this that is very convincing. The swimming pool scenes feel like real water to me.
Are quite convincing, but it's got all the ingredients I love. Right? It is an artist's story. The actors in it have some kind of connection to the material that allows you to sort of imagine what. For me, it's kind of probably an actor nerdy thing. I'm like, what are they, you know, using as material to sort of dive into the scene? So it's got all that stuff that I love. And I also, and I don't think you guys did this on purpose, but in terms of like art direction, I went from this very blue experience to this kind of orange autumnal kind of sepia vibe. And so it was
avocado.
Less avocado, more grapefruit. But it was a nice shift from Avatar. I loved watching Riley. I've never seen her act before and was quite surprised at how good she was. She is a Nepo baby that I think perhaps is deserving of where she currently sits. But I was interested in the story. It does the things. For me, that I like to spend my time, my limited free time doing, thinking about what it means to be married and support somebody in their dream, thinking about what it means to support my own dream. And there were very little consequence to all of the shenanigans they were up for. So it was fluffy in that way, and I appreciate it.
All right. So, yeah, I love that when you emailed that there's, you know, because I think you're right about that. Not too many consequences considering some of the stuff that they're doing. So, Sean, you have the floor. I'm not sure I know your exact attitude towards Daisy Jones and the Six, but I'm about to find out.
I thought it was terrible, man. There were no 10 feet tall blue people anywhere to be seen. Just really wasn't my bag. No, I really liked it. It was, I think we were talking a little bit about how the one sort of shortcoming of this and many projects like this is that the music will never be as good as it's supposed to be, like diegetically or like inside the story. Like it's like these are fine, but it's like how could you get a musician to actually make a great album worth of songs for this thing unless it's like their album? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because if you had like, it'd be great if you could just get like Stevie Nicks, like, hey, you just make like a version of which you would have made back then for this, it'll rule, and then we'll have a really great show. But they don't have that, so they had to do. They had to make do. Songs are fine, but it's like if they were like amazing, I mean, this might be the show of the year.
Right. I mean, to that
you
point,
would think
Sean,
in 2023, they'd be smart enough to understand how IP works and to actually go in that direction.
Well, they're actually releasing the album of the stuff, which I have no intention of listening to. But Sean, I think that is, you know, this, there's two areas where it's really hard to do this in a movie or in a TV show. One of them is comedy, you know, and like Pants is very fond of this horrible Aaron Sorkin program called Studio 60, which is basically about making Saturday Night Live. But the problem is every time they had to have a scene where, as you say, diegetically or within the context of the thing, it had to be this home run of funniness. It wasn't, because Aaron Sorkin isn't funny that way. And it's hard to be funny at that level, unless you're Tina Fey or somebody. And I agree about this, which is that this is a really hard thing to do, to make some music that would make you think, wow, these people are going to go on to fill Soldier Field at some point with screaming fans a la Fleetwood Mac. And Sean, I had the same reaction. I thought, whoa. You know, they're really asking me to believe a lot, but maybe we just should anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I'll buy it for the sake of, you know what I mean? I choose to believe that the people that exist in the show that aren't in the band are just a little less, like, into music than we are as people in the real world, and that'll just get me through it. But can we just talk about, if we want to criticize dialogue, the dialogue in the show is generally fine, but there is one line in the show that is just worse than anything he said in Avatar, which was, what is the producer, Teddy Price?
Yeah.
There's a scene where he talks about how Jay-Z Jones walks away from him when they first met, and he's like, sometimes the back of someone is the best way to see who they really, like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? What does that mean? That doesn't mean anything.
There was one great line, I thought, when the bass player at one point is talking about the incredible popularity of the band, and then he said, but, you know, they call it a moment for a reason. And I thought, that's actually, I wouldn't mind having written that line. Hey, Jim, maybe you could say a little bit either about the musicianship or, you know, the clip that we played actually includes one of the real mysteries of life, which is how does the collaborative process work when, say, two people write a song, whether it's, you know, Kander and Ebb sitting down to write New York, New York, or Lennon and McCartney. Well, now we know that. We've seen 7.5 hours of Lennon and McCartney were doing. But you know, I don't know. How much of that kind of thing rang true for you?
Well, I revisited the music a little bit because I know that it doesn't sound like hits, but they weren't slackers with it. They got Blake Mills, who's a great sort of producer, guitar player, who understands the context that he's working in to kind of oversee it. And they have people like Phoebe Bridgers writing. I forget who. There's a big list of writers. And I think there were 25 songs. I think that either the failure of or success of the way we perceive the music is there's at no point is there an entire song, I don't think, right? It's just we're hearing a verse and a chorus and a cutaway, or maybe a verse and a chorus and a B section or something.
Well, the more the series goes along, the more it becomes like that. They're just stage shots, and yeah, you hear a verse and a chorus. Or
right.
Something. I think initially we might hear something close to a full song. Yeah.
We actually get to hear parts of enough of a song so that some of them should have become real viral hooks that keep us up at night. And there aren't that many of those. I don't think I lost any sleep with any of these songs in my head. I don't know. I think the songs are just there to kind of hold up the structure, but they're a little bit more than that, I'd say. They're not, you know, if you think about the Monkees or I don't know, the Jackson 5, these young groups that didn't have the chops to quite, well, I shouldn't even compare those two in the same sentence, so you could chastise me later. But the Wrecking Crew was behind the Monkees, so they were great musicians, you know, doing, and they had writers writing for them. So I think the same thing here. The Jackson 5 had great musicians and great writers when they first started. But their talent pulled all that team together. They became the nose, if you will, of the song to deliver it. I don't know that that exists in this context. The closest we get is Elvis's granddaughter, I think, yes. who kind of grew on me, even though they're all self-indulgent, sort of semi-loathsome people to begin with.
So, you know, I have already opined on this to the panel, so I'm not going to say too much about it, but I'm going to throw it to you, Tanisha. So we're talking about this band of six people And then there's Teddy, and then there's Timothy Olyphant. I'm actually kind of hoping that Sean near the end will have something to say about Timothy Olyphant. He's like in everything these days, and is like, I don't know. It must be so interesting to be Timothy Olyphant. But Tanisha, there's this whole second plot that's going on, into which we kind of dive in and out, involving a singer named Simone Jackson, who kind of initially seems a little bit like the woman whose, I think her first name was Claudia, who sang on Give Me Shelter. She's kind of 20 feet from stardom. But then she moves to New York and becomes kind of a disco queen. She falls into a relationship with another woman named Bernie. These two women, these two characters are the black characters along with Teddy in this. And I don't know, I had a very specific reaction to how that parallelism was handled. And you already know what my cranky take was. But I was wondering what anybody else thought. Tanisha, I mean, how did that work for you?
I mean, I guess when it became clear she wasn't Riley Keough's lover, I was sort of like, okay, well, why do we need her? And you know, I'm only into episode 7, so I don't know if Bernie and what is her name?
Simone Jackson.
Donna Summer. Simone, you know, I don't know where that evolves to. Mm-hmm. But when it popped back come episode 6 or 7, I was a little like, why are we doing this? You know, are we trying to make a statement about the different kind of pop stars, no matter what people call themselves, whether it's just whatever the genre, they're all pop stars to me. You know, what the different pathways for a pop star of a certain type in that time is going through, but that doesn't feel like the story to me. So it feels to me like either an unnecessary side story, or perhaps maybe worse, an attempt to sort of include folks in the story that don't need to be included. And I'm totally fine with staying true to what the experience is, right? Like I'm totally fine. You know, there's a part of me that's like, I don't really understand why Teddy Price is the producer, but that's okay. Like,
yes, I will say that as you see the other episodes, I don't think you will have more answers to your questions. And I won't even discuss the last thing that really made me mad, because we don't have time. We do have about 60 seconds, Sean. And we have to say, I mean, I love Timothy Olyphant. And, you know, Jim says there's no hook keeping him awake at night from these songs. What keeps me awake at night are Timothy Olyphant's two different hairstyles in this, because like he's in the 70s and then he's in the present and he's got this porn star mustache. And I don't know, Sean, I have to hear the Sean Murray take on all this.
My take is Timothy Olyphant, keep getting them checks, baby. Like he's just popping up and everything. He's doing whatever he wants. This is obviously not a production decision to have him to have those hairstyles. It was an executive decision. He's like, you want Timmy? Timmy's going to bring his own hair and makeup team, baby. And I love it.
All right. That's as good a place to end as any. We're going to take a little break here. We're going to come back, and the panel will talk about the things that they like and recommend.
I don't know who I am. Baby, baby, baby. Do you know who you are? Is it out of our hands? Tell me, tell me, tell me how we made it this far. Did we unravel a long time ago? Is there too much we don't want to know?
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In Community Speaker Series, May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speakerseries.
Okay, I got to go a little bit fast here, but thanks to our wonderful technical producer, Kat Pastor, she got us through yet another week. And always, pretty much always, the producer of The Nose is our producer, Jonathan McPitts. He is the producer today, and I think next week and next week and next week and so on. So now it's time to make some recommendations to you. We have no idea what Bill Curry's recommendations would be. But Tanisha Dugan, why don't you get us going with one or two of yours?
I will, and I'll be quick, and I'll do one. It is springtime, so you all know I'm starting to putter around in the dirt, in the garden. So I want to do one shout out to a local favorite, our friends over at Heirloom Market, the Comstock Fair Seed Company. They are always representing rare seeds, Baker's Heirloom Seeds. Love them so, so much. And if you are still got some time to order, I love Botanical Interests. The seed packets are gorgeous, and they've got really good information if you're new to the gardening or old and just need to be reminded, like, how long does the carrot germinate before I need to put it in the ground? So those are my two. Happy spring, guys.
Plant a carrot, get a carrot. Somebody should write a song about that. You should ask them. You should bring in a picture of a plant from, you know, from Avatar. Say, do you have these things that glow and they talk to you and stuff and they wrestle boats out of the water and stuff? I want those.
They probably have them.
Yeah, they probably do. Oh, if they don't, nobody does. Mr. Jim Chapdelaine, what have you got for us?
I've been on a work binge, so I have not left my house unless by legal order. So I come in from my studio, and I'm a really late arrival to the show Luther with Idris Elba, a British sort of crime drama, which I normally wouldn't like, but I like him so much that I got hooked on the show. And I started, it was just a movie, and then I stumbled across, like, oh, Lord, it's a whole series. Now there's five seasons. So I'm kind of being a glutton with that show. So I recommend it if you like him, and how can you not? He's in the show, and it's, I think it was made in 2010, so everybody's young and pretty.
Right. The old ones, yeah, and they actually, they have their old Timothy Oliphant hairstyle.
Timothy Oliphant is in this, by the way.
Of course he is. Yeah. Of course he is. Yeah. So, I like Luther, too. I haven't watched the new one. It got kind of a not really great review from Mike Hale in the New York Times.
Well, the new one was the movie, right?
Yeah,
it's a movie. It's very torture-y. I'm not a big torture
The old series is terrific, though. All right. So, time for Sean. I'm still laughing. I'm going to laugh all weekend about You Want Timmy. But that will make me laugh four or five times this weekend. But, Sean, what are you going to recommend today?
Glad to hear it. I would like to recommend The Black Jacobins, spelled Jacobins, Toussaint Louverture and the Saint Domingo Revolution. It's a book by C.L.R. James, A History of the Haitian Revolution. I'm not finished with it, but it's the most amazing thing. I think the Haitian Revolution is the most amazing thing that ever happened in the world, and we never talk about it in America specifically. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. They overthrew France. Slaves did it. It's incredible. I would like to recommend that. It's a great book, great piece of history. Also like to recommend amazing album that came out a couple weeks ago, Praise the Lord Who Choose But Which Does Not Consume by Yves Tumor. Yves like Yves Saint Laurent. Amazing experimental rock / R&B / so many things album. It's lush, it's crazy, but it's so focused and amazing. And also one last thing, it's an album by Danny Brown and JPEG Mafia called Scaring the Hoes. I'm just filling in for Sam Hadelman, who would obviously recommend that to Colin. And Colin would be like, why are you recommending this weird hip hop album? But I have to. Scaring the Hoes, it's weird, experimental also, and it's crazy.
The title link is going to turn up in my text in about 30 seconds. You know that.
I'm sure.
For samples. Say the title and artist of the one you mentioned before that, the album.
The artist is Yves Tumor, like Yves, like Yves Saint Laurent. And the title of the album is Praise the Lord Who Choose, But Which Does Not Consume.
All right. So, by the way, McPants will put all this stuff up on our show page at ctpublic.org/Colin, and it's up on all. It'll be up on all of our social media sites too. All of the recommendations that you just heard. I'm gonna. We have a show coming up next week. We have a show about fandom, and then it's followed by a show about hate watching or hate listening and all this kind of stuff. It's our two interns are doing it. We're very excited about it. And so, for a long time recently, I thought hate listening to a podcast called The Pivot. It's hosted by Kara Swisher and Scott Galloway. I really, really do enjoy Mr. Galloway, although he insists on acting like an idiot a lot of the time. But he's just this brilliant guy. And Kara Swisher, you know, is very, very, very smart. But she kind of gets on my nerves. She's trying to be too cool for school all the time. And But I realized that I listened to every single damn episode, and I also take my hat off to them. They went back into the studio. They just left from doing a podcast episode. Trump was indicted. They went right back in and did a whole other one. And I've learned a lot about business from listening to them talk. And so I'm recommending The Pivot, and I'm trying to get over whatever contradictory feelings I have about it, and just acknowledge that I like it and they're smart and it's good. And then I'll quickly say, we did a show with Emily St. John Mandel. It ran yesterday. One thing that I didn't say is, I think if you're starting out, and a lot of people who heard the show thought they maybe wanted to get into her books, I would start with The Glass Hotel and then go to Sea of Tranquility. And then if you haven't read Station 11, you can do that then. But I think that's the right sequence. At least that's what I'm going to say for now. Meanwhile, thanks to everybody who listened. Thanks to our wonderful four members of our panel today. Thanks to Sean and Tanisha and Jim and Bill. And thanks to McPants and Kat. And we'll be back next week with some fun stuff.
Across from St. Francis, past the conservatory, up the street from the seminary. You know, it's a very, very, very cool place to hang out. Yeah, it's cozy, like a Cracker Barrel. Yeah, we all be laughing, talking, joking, talking about this and talking about that, and talk about everything as a matter of fact. Oh yeah, talk about Torrington, Vernon, Danbury, Waterbury, Oliveberry, Woodbury, hitting on New Britain. Vernon, I already said that one. Avon, Farmington. Yeah, 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 yeah.